going to look at how President Trump's job performance so far is affecting partisan politics in individual states. And we will wonder if Trump is hurting Republicans and helping Democrats. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. As President Trump closes in on his first 100 days in office, there have been a couple of different special elections in Kansas and in Georgia that were being regarded as referendums on his presidency. While Democrats did not get the big wins they were looking for in those races, they did come close, and we will talk about what this means, and we'll welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Jasmine Ferrier is with us, a professor of political science at the University of Louisville. She received her bachelor's degree in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning, and welcome back to Wisconsin via the radio.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you.
Let's start with this week's special election to replace Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price in Georgia's 6th Congressional District. Democrat John Ossoff, a candidate making his first bid for elective office, narrowly missed winning outright against several Republicans in what is seen as a heavily conservative district. He now faces a runoff election with the top Republican vote getter. I think that'll be in June. But both parties now are claiming victory. Who do you think came out as the real winner?
Well, just as a hedge to the answer, open seats are more volatile than when incumbents are seeking re-election. So by their nature, special elections are inherently open seats, and the outcome can be spun in lots of different ways. As you hinted, the Democratic Party, of course, was looking for an outright victory because that would signal some kind of resistance, as they're putting it, to the Trump agenda, while Republicans are simply hailing that the runoff could create stability in the Republican seat.
The Democratic candidate needed to garner 50% of the vote or more,
right,
and then he would have won outright. But instead, there were a dozen Republicans running? I don't even remember. There's a lot of Republicans running, and that Republican vote was presumably split among them all. The top vote getter on the Republican side got like 14% of the vote, something like that.
Yes, it was a low number. Now, and honestly, I think that we need to spend more time on that question. Why were there so many Republicans splitting the party's vote? And this is a hint about what's to come when Republicans are split internally about how to take on Democratic candidates and whether or not to defend Donald Trump. Although it's a little unusual, that we have to remember we had 17 Republicans just a year ago about fighting it out during the primary. And that type of fragmented party is not going to bode well for next year.
Yeah. The Republican candidate who did emerge the top vote getter among all the Republicans, do you know off the top of your head if she represented conservative, moderate, something else?
Well, I think that her name is Karen Handel, and I think that she is very openly embracing Donald Trump, which is a somewhat risky strategy. He has, of course, tweeted support, and she said she welcomes his attention to the race and any help that he can get. I was looking around some political sites this morning. I saw her everywhere. She has a lot of advertising budget right now. She's on Politico, for example. There are lots of pop-up ads. So I think that she's well-funded. She's being aggressive, and again, she's seeking the president, which is not something that all Republicans may be doing next year.
Interesting, yeah. And President Trump did get involved in this race at the day or so before the actual election itself. He did he voiced a robocall that said, don't let this liberal Democrat take this seat away from the Republicans.
Yeah, so it will be a proxy race. It will be bruising and obviously very expensive. The symbolism of special elections, though, are limited because, again, the dynamics of those elections are so different. Not only do you not have an incumbent, so therefore the seat is more volatile, but also you don't have the noise of other races taking place at the same time. So even though they're considered these bellwethers for the next year, the truth is we don't know what they mean yet.
Yeah. Both state and national Democrats were pouring a lot of resources into this race. What was so important about this race for Democrats?
It's the symbolism of translating energy from the Democratic base into a legislative win, meaning taking an actual seat. So you can have all the marches that you want, and you can have the fierce rhetoric against the president, but actually chipping away at his House majority is probably the most important priority for the Democratic Party next year.
Yeah. So how, how easy or difficult it might it be for Democrats to take this seat in the June election?
Well, it might be possible. I think that it'll be a very close race. I don't think that that's a shocker to predict. But for next year, including the seat, Democrats need to have a net gain of about 24 seats in the House, which that doesn't sound like a lot. It's only 5% of the full House membership. But there are usually only 5% of the House vulnerable in any given year. So in other words, for Democrats to retake the majority next year, they'd have to maintain every seat that they have, hardly have a loss, and take on a net gain of 24 Republican seats. And that's going to be a tall order.
Yeah. Let's also talk about there was a special House election in Kansas last
yes.
week. So this Democratic victory of sorts comes on the heels of a better-than-expected performance by the Democrat in that Kansas election. But again, the Democrat in Kansas did not win.
That's right. So we have to remember that. Again, the narrative can be spun in lots of different ways, but at the end, the win is what matters. Now, Kansas is a little bit different in that the Republican Party has had a lot of drama with the governor, Governor Sam Brownback, being one of the least popular governors in the United States right now. So it's hard for us to take away too many national trends when often some of these reflections are local.
In this case, do you think it was local?
Well, yeah. So it's both a combination of Trump and, of course, the way that the Republican Party is on the downturn in Kansas. But again, that might be temporary. But it's very hard for us, unless we're on the ground there, to understand how the average voter is really mixing all of these different types of political signals. Because House elections, by their nature, are local. And then, of course, we have the state party dynamics as well as the national dynamics. And we can assume how any voter is prioritizing those three layers. But, of course, it's very sensitive to whatever the local concerns are.
Well, it does seem as though, at least they've been looked at as though these elections are being regarded as referendums on Trump's presidency so far. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yes, it's a fair assessment, but voter turnout needs to be higher for it to be a more of a referendum. And honestly, again, I think that we all want to have some kind of narrative to tie these races together, and that's the most compelling one, but local elections are just more volatile by their nature. And again, that open seat is not exactly what we're going to see next year. Most incumbents win elections. So the next year's election will be featuring mostly incumbents. So with those types of statistics, there will be an uphill battle for Democrats. On the other hand, midterm elections, especially the first midterm election, is traditionally a big splash for the opposite party. So I think that President Trump is going to have to gird himself, and so will Republicans in the House and Senate, for some loss. Maybe it's not a loss of a majority, but they're probably going to lose seats if historical trends hold true.
Yeah. What is your assessment of the political mood in this country right now?
That's a great question, and I think that the president would want that answer above anything else. I don't think that it's a clear mood at all. This is an ideologically flexible president. It's very hard to say what is sacred to him, both in theory and policy. We've had a lot of news stories about his flipping on certain key issues. It could be as big as healthcare, what he wants to keep from Obamacare and what he wants to shed. tax reform, infrastructure, world affairs, of course, the strike against Syria when he had earlier said he would not do that. So it's very hard to say what it is that he wants to explain going forward is the basic narrative of his presidency. On the other hand, he is a disruptor, and I think that that's where he made his biggest splashes in the early weeks, that he got people to pay attention. He seemed to shake up the establishment, as he promised. And if it's the method of acting that is most interesting to him, then he will probably continue to try to disrupt. Because, again, that gets attention, and attention gets focus. And Congress is going to be quite chaotic for the next few months.
We'll jump on that point when we come back from news from Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the recent special elections in Kansas and Georgia, where Democrats were hoping to upset the Republicans and take those seats. That did not happen, but the Democrats did have better-than-expected showings in both of those districts. We're talking about what that means, talking about whether President Trump's job performance so far is worrying Republicans, hurting Republicans, or not. Welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And we'll also talk about U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and the Democratic National Committee Tom Perez kicked off a roadshow this week. They're on a what's being called a Democratic Unity Tour, and they're also talking about how the Democrats can win in 2018 and beyond. And we'll talk about that as well. And we'll wonder what you think. Do you think that that Democrats have a lot of work to do to recover from their losses this past fall? Do you think they have a chance of taking over some of the seats anyway in Congress in the 2018 elections? Let us know your thoughts and questions. Our guest is Jasmine Ferrier. She's a professor of political science at the University of Louisville. She is a graduate of UW-Madison. Jim in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good morning. I was wondering what your guests thought of the $8 million that Ossoff put into this. And according to the NPR article I'm reading, 95% of that came from outside of the state. With 13 or 14 other congressional seats in Georgia, how are they going to sustain that kind of, you know, money coming in? It seems like an awful lot. And when you look at it, he got less than half the votes, and there were only 200,000 votes cast. Mm-hmm. That's an awful lot of money per vote.
Yeah. So a lot of outside money in this particular race, presumably Professor Ferrier from Democratic or progressive groups that really, really, really wanted the Democratic candidate to win there?
And it's a great question. A special election, again, without any noise, without all the competitive elections around it, it's going to attract a lot of attention because both sides wanted this symbolic victory. And the caller is correct that it's not sustainable to have that amount of high-profile fundraising. But as he also pointed out, low turnout is actually the key factor here. And I think that Americans are sometimes a little cynical, thinking that money is all that politicians seek and it's all they need. And sometimes perhaps the political establishment looks at it the same way. It's actually bodies that win elections. And we look at the presidential race last year, how close things were. We look at, for example, just a quick detour to my state in Kentucky. My governor, Governor Matt Bevin, won a four-way Republican primary by 83 votes. And that turnout was barely in the double digits for the Republican primary in Kentucky, and that was just a couple of years ago. So I want the listeners to remember that bodies are much more important in some cases than the money. Rather than sustaining that high level of campaign contributions, both parties would be much more well invested by looking at ground gains and turnout.
Yeah. So, again, Democrats were really hoping for wins in Georgia and in Kansas, still reeling from the big defeats in November. Are these two races, they lost, but are they? Do they look at them as moral victories? That you know, is it enough to keep the momentum moving forward, or is this really demoralizing for Democrats?
Well, Democrats, like any opposition party, has to take stock of a couple of things. One is whether or not they're going to make this person, the president, the focus of all campaigns, and tie him as a yoke around every single Republican in the United States. And Democrats have done that before. Obviously, Republicans have done that before with President Obama, and that was a very successful tactic. George W. Bush, when his popularity was declining, did not hug Republican candidates very closely, and they were quite happy with that distance. So it's very normal for one party to try to tie and morph everybody together and the other party to separate. But it doesn't seem for now, as I mentioned before, that the Republican candidate in Georgia, former Secretary of State in Georgia, Karen Handel, is actually going to push the president away. So I think that's a much more interesting test of President Trump's impact on next year's races. If he had been rebuffed, or if he was told to stay out of that race and not even do the robocall, then we would probably be thinking that that was an indicator for next year, too.
Yeah, speaking of backing President Trump, there, we have a caller. Actually, it's an emailer that Matt from Wausau emailed, says that Trump has lowered the bar so low that I don't think the office of president will ever be the same. His lies go unchallenged by most Republicans and have come up so quickly it is dizzying. Republicans that once criticized Donald Trump just march alongside with him now. How embarrassing. Talk a little bit about that. It's true that a number of Republicans were not all that wild about a Donald Trump presidency. Some, including Speaker Paul Ryan, were actively criticizing him, but not anymore. Tell us what's happening.
It's a very good question. It's complicated. I would say that the first order of business for any political party, especially in a two-party system, is to figure out what it stands for. And for me, looking beyond Trump as a fascinating character and perhaps even a distraction to the real existential crisis that is engulfing the Republican Party and has been engulfing it for the past decade. So let's go back a little bit. George W. Bush inspired the Tea Party wave, not necessarily President Obama, because George W. Bush was a big government conservative. He believed in war, nation building, expanding entitlements at home, and immigration reform. So remember, that's all George W. Bush. And so the Tea Party was both aimed at Democrats, but also at these so-called establishment Republicans, such as Mitch McConnell, John Boehner, and so forth. So what did Trump do to help the Republican Party establish its identity? And I'm not sure that he did anything because, frankly, he's not a Republican, and not in a traditional sense. I mean, he may have some conservative spasms, you know, lower taxes, that's pretty normal. But the truth is he believes in protectionism for American workers. He's anti-free trade. And between the two parties, it's very hard to find any ideological consistency on foreign policy. Each party just basically doesn't like what the other president is doing, but it doesn't mean that their occupants in the White House actually changed the strategy. So if we're talking about a big domestic investment in economic achievement for everyday Americans, if we're talking about intervening in the free market the way President Trump did with Carrier, the air conditioning industry leader in Indiana to save jobs, if he's going to continue to do all that, I'm not sure that the Republican Party is in favor of free markets. So although the emailer is correct that Trump as a personality is distracting, his media sound bites can be very difficult for other Republicans to have to absorb. But I think that this bigger question still is unresolved.
We are talking with Jasmine Ferrier, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. We're talking about President Donald Trump's effect on Republicans and Democrats with two special elections in Kansas and Georgia being regarded as referendums on his presidency so far. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions. What do you think it will take for Democrats to make any inroads in terms of picking up seats in the 2018 elections? And what about Republicans? Should Republicans embrace Donald Trump and his policies or not? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, also this week, Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez and Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders hit the road for what is being called a Democratic Unity Tour. Professor Ferrier, what's the goal here?
Well, unlike the Republican Party, which was fragmented 17 different ways last year, the Democratic Party was fragmented only two ways. But they were two very significant factions of the party. And with Perez being considered somewhat of a proxy for the establishment Hillary Clinton side of the party and Bernie Sanders being Bernie Sanders, they're trying to get this Democratic energy going. And in fact, they just had a camp, they just did their show in Louisville this week. So they're doing a national tour, as you just mentioned. I do want to, before I answer the question about the Democratic Party, I want to remind listeners, I hate to say this is my professorial mode, but the Constitution has a lot of structural features that sometimes go underappreciated, and we look at the Constitution for clues about rights and privileges and group identity, constitutional protections. We also look to the Constitution for the powers of the government, the national government versus the states. But I want to remind everybody that one of the most interesting and endurable features of the Constitution is actually the way elections are structured. And that has a tremendous impact on what is going to happen next year. So, for example, all 435 House seats are up for election next year, but the Constitution allows the states to district those particular races in the sense that we call it gerrymandering or redistricting. But states are allowed to draw their own districts, and that's partly why only 5% of the entire House is even considered remotely volatile. And Democrats and Republicans place those vulnerable members on a list, and you can look them up. So the Democrats have a list. It's called a frontline program, and they list all their vulnerable Democrats, and there are only 18 of them. The Republicans have only 10 vulnerable House members, as they see it, for next year. And the reason why they publicize that is just to get some extra fundraising. But the point is, in 435 seats, there are only 18 or so seats that are even considered volatile. Mm-hmm. That's very low. And we have to remember why that is. And again, that's because of state-based redistricting. Mm-hmm. On the Senate side, though, and this is where things get interesting in Wisconsin, of course, because Tammy Baldwin is up for re-election next year. But on the Senate side, there's a constitutional randomness by the class system. So if you don't mind indulging me just for a few more seconds, every senator is elected on a certain clock. And the Constitution mandates that one-third of the Senate is up every 2 years. Of course, everybody gets the full six-year term. So Tammy Baldwin, if you go to U.S. Senate and go to Senate.gov and hit the members, you can search by class. And so I'm looking at the list of people that are up for re-election. And this is, again, just the randomness of the Constitution. There are about 31, 32 senators up for re-election next year. I think that 22 or 23 of them are Democrats. So just by the randomness of the election, Democrats have to defend two or three times more seats than Republicans next year, including seats in states that Donald Trump won. So, for example, Tammy Baldwin, Senator Brown from Ohio, we can go down this list, and there are a lot of vulnerable Democrats. And for the Democrats to take the Senate, they have to keep all their seats and flip three. And it seems that, you can tell me, is Senator Baldwin in any trouble? Are nearby races where Democrats lost in the White House last year in trouble?
You could tell that it's she's being focused on by even Governor Walker tweeting, you know, criticisms and such at her. And there is there's no there are some Republicans who are mulling a run, including the daughter of a of a trucking company in Wisconsin is. But yeah, I mean, right now there's not a clear cut opponent announced. But yeah, it's interesting. When you think of Wisconsin being the entire state legislature is Republican, or at least majority Republican. The governor's office is Republican. More of the congressional seats are in districts that are Republican. She is a Democratic U.S. senator in a very a red state in many ways.
Yes, and of course, Wisconsin is one of only a few states that have a split Senate delegation. Mm-hmm. And so that reflects the very closeness of the election last year in Wisconsin, and that's going to play out. So I think that you're going to get more attention in some ways than you may anticipate. Even if she's personally popular, there is obviously a lot of volatility in Wisconsin. And as I mentioned, there's neighboring Ohio, neighboring to us, I should say, in Kentucky. Also near both of us is Pennsylvania, and we can go down the list. There are a lot of vulnerable Democrats, and again, for the Democrats to keep all of those seats and flip three more is going to be a tall order.
Yeah. Then again, there's a long time between now and 2018, too. But
that is true.
With President Trump's lower than usual, I guess, approval ratings. Does that play into the picture at all?
Well, that's a good question. I apologize for neglecting that part of the previous caller's response. Yes, is there going to be an effect on the presidency for Donald Trump? And I think that the answer probably is yes, but it may not be a long-term effect. And frankly, maybe it was a correction that needed to be done. I think that we have a very, very skewed and somewhat distorted view of the U.S. presidency. And this is, of course, threaded throughout the 20th century, so we can't really blame ourselves. And it's a cycle that feeds on itself, where presidents make outrageous campaign promises. And I mean outrageous on both sides. The unilateral assumptions that are made during presidential elections are just stunning to me, because I teach the presidency and I teach Congress, and I have to unlearn basically everything my students think is true about presidents snapping their fingers and getting laws passed. Executive orders are not as broad sweeping as people think, and those can be overturned as well, as we found out through the court system. So the truth is, we have a separated system where presidents are supposed to execute the law. And if you look at that root word for more than a few seconds, you realize that executives go second. Think about the root word of the word executioner. The executioner is not the jury and the judge. It's the person carrying it out. So we have a very different view. In fact, I might argue we have a flipped view about how political life really happens. If the president doesn't go first and Congress goes second, it's actually supposed to be that Congress goes first and the president goes second. And there's no amount of base energy or mandates from the election that can really change the formal powers of the president. All that stuff is informal. So the so-called mandate, his relationship with the media, the party coherence or not, the way that the president presents himself, the way he can go over the heads of Congress to reach individuals in their living rooms, all of that is true, and that's a real power, but it's a power that impacts the formal powers. They're not powers in and of themselves. And the formal power and the true test of President Trump's first 100 days, unfortunately for him, are in Congress's hands.
We are talking with Jasmine Farrier, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. She's a graduate of UW-Madison, and we're talking politics. We're talking about the prospects of Democrats making any gains in the midterm elections based on President Trump's first 100 days. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Jasmine Farrier, a professor of political science at the University of Louisville, about the special elections in Kansas and Georgia and how they have been regarded as referendums on President Trump's presidency so far. Democrats did not get the big wins that they were looking for, but they did better than expected. What do we garner from that? And what... What are the chances that Democrats will make some inroads in the midterm elections based on President Trump? Should Republicans be embracing President Trump? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Before we move on to some other issues, Paul from Eau Claire emailed, and he says, Democrats did not win in either Georgia or Kansas. A mere 3% of Trump voters regret voting for him. Trump won 30 states. It is delusional optimism to believe that Democrats are rebounding right now. Is he right, Professor Farrell?
There's only one winner for a seat, and the Democrats lost both of those seats. So, I mean, they didn't have them to begin with, but they were trying to turn this energy into a positive, tangible win, and they did not get that. So, in that sense, yes, he's correct, or she. You have to win to get the power in the U.S. Congress. So, beating the odds or doing better than expected really does not help the narrative of capitalizing on this energy. However, it may actually strengthen the Democratic Party's resolve because the wins were close, relatively, especially in Georgia. So you really might think that the party is going to strategize and try to figure out what went wrong and where they need to do better turnout messages, better advertising, and bring in more other celebrities of sorts, political and otherwise, to energize the base. So maybe there are lessons learned and both parties will fine-tune from this experience. I think that the question of whether people regret voting for Trump is a very interesting one, and it's hard for political pollsters and public opinion specialists to tease that out. I think that it depends, who's going to turn out next year. Are the disappointed people going to stay home? And if so, how does that change the race itself? So remember, you need the voters. And I think that both parties need to keep that in mind even more so than the fundraising part of it.
Yeah. Just before our news break, you were talking about how people are maybe going to be mad at Congress before they're mad at the president. Did I get that right?
Well, maybe they're not taking it out on Congress quite yet, but from my standpoint, trying to teach American politics, again, is an uphill battle, even though I'm teaching college students, because people don't know what Congress is supposed to do. And Congress is listed first in the Constitution. It's the longest of the seven articles. It's the most specific of the three branches. And the enumerated powers of Congress span both domestic and foreign policy. And so when you read the Constitution and you read the newspaper, you don't get a sense that we are at all connected here. So going to the earlier question about whether President Trump is downgrading the presidency as an institution, again, maybe that's true. We've had bad moments before. Think about the Nixon and Ford years, and Carter did not necessarily help that rebound either. So the entire 70s as a decade was not a great decade for the presidency. And then one of Reagan's accomplishments is theoretically that he rebounded the presidency itself. And we've had higher expectations ever since. I'm not sure that we need to have a permanently heroic, large, all-encompassing president. I don't know that that's the system that was designed to work. And even if you like the president, which is part of the calculation here, you want a strong presidency when we like the guy in office. The system, because it atrophies Congress, who should be on the upswell.
Yeah, your phone is fading a little bit, so I hope we don't lose power. But let me ask you, because President Trump, as a candidate and early on in the presidency, was saying we are going to repeal and replace Obamacare, and the replacement's going to be, it's going to be great, and here that was. He was campaigning with, trying to lobby Republicans to go for it, and yet they did not, and that was a failure. He was in Wisconsin this week, and he was saying, hey, make sure your Republican congressmen support what we want to, repeal and replace Obamacare. So he's still working on that. I mean, that's he doesn't have everybody on board on that, though.
No, and it's a very complicated question, as he finally had to admit. Healthcare is very difficult for most people to understand because, of course, we understand it in our own personal context. Where do we get our health insurance? Is it from our employer? Are we self-insured through an individual transaction? Do we get it from the government? And sometimes in a household, you can have a combination of all three. And, of course, you can have uninsured people. We also think personally, how much do we pay for it? And this is so complicated, not only on an individual and family level, but obviously it's a fifth of our economy. And it's going to be a very lumbering industry to change abruptly. Put into all of that volatility, the fact that, as I said before, President Trump is not a Republican in ideological senses. He is a very pragmatic person. I think he wants a win for the sake of having a win. He made a campaign promise. He's happy to fulfill it. He's not going to bother himself with the details. And that's a style of presidential leadership that, frankly, we've seen before. We saw it with George W. Bush. We saw it with Ronald Reagan, to some success, honestly. Presidents don't have to be bogged down in details to be successful in certain measures. But the truth is, what is it that Republicans are proposing to replace it? And that's, of course, where things got very hairy. And it's not a shock that Republicans could not come up with a plan when they've had 7 years to do so and have not produced something that has consensus behind it. Now, yes, you can have individual Republican replacement plans, and frankly, some Democrats want to see some tinkering and if not outright replacement with a public option. So, in other words, this is a very complicated issue. You cannot overstate how complicated it is. And politically speaking, there is not as much difference between the parties on the question of whether or not the government should help people get to health care.
Yeah.
In that ideological question, believe it or not, we're not as divided as we think. And this is a difference between a partisan divide and a true ideological divide. Parties can hate each other, and you can hate the opposition party with every fiber of your being, but it doesn't mean that you're actually that far apart on ideas. The problem with politics is that there's an incentive to exaggerate the differences rather than work together right now.
Let's go to Jeremy in Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I believe the Democrat Party, they have to find some form of a common ground with Donald Trump and work with that and build from that. That's what the voters want. Nobody on the Democrat side really likes Donald Trump. This last election cycles that you're hearing reports on, yeah. So the turnouts are low because a lot of people got their teeth kicked in the last election cycle, and they're a little worn out, and rightfully so. That was a tough loss to have. People are really fed up with politicians grandstanding and nothing getting done. The middle class and lower class people in this country is getting our teeth kicked in out here. Things are becoming more expensive. Wages are stagnant. Yeah, there are jobs, but there's not enough educated people to get into these jobs. So that's another compounding problem.
Jeremy, I'm going to jump in because we're so short on time. But the overall thrust of his comment to Professor Ferrier, the Democrats need to work with President Trump. That's what the people want.
That's right. So I think that's a good point. And the fact that I said that Trump is ideologically flexible is something that the Democrats can capitalize on in two ways. One is that there's a difference between common ground and compromise, and the caller used the phrase common ground. And all politicians need to take a lesson from that. Common ground is politically palatable, but compromise is not always politically palatable. The second point is that, related to the earlier conversation, when Republicans in Congress are divided, they can't perform as a majority party. By the way, we haven't even mentioned that the 100th day is going to coincide with possibly a government budget shutdown. So for the president to get anything done, and again, he's a deal maker, he's going to have to work with Democrats because Republicans may not get it together. In that sense, the caller is correct that Republicans may see themselves pushed aside, and Democrats in both the House and the Senate may have to start to deliver these wins. And then perhaps we'll see some bipartisan action.
Just expand on that a little bit. The 100-day mark might happen during a government shutdown?
Well, there is a continuing resolution, which is a short-term budget agreement that was put in place last fall. It expires next week, and the president's 100th day will also take place next week. and there are only 5 working days for Congress to work out the details of a temporary budget agreement. I do not expect a grand bargain. It will probably be another continuing resolution, which means, again, another short-term spending compromise that simply does nothing other than continue the past priorities. But here's the irony. We have a lot of big elections. We have a lot of big news stories. But mostly the day-to-day life of Congress is continuing the past. President Trump inherited war powers from President Obama. The Congress inherited the previous Congress's budget. And the truth is, elections are not the break from the past that we often assume they are. And that's what feeds this cycle of disappointment and expectation. We do not stop everything and start over. So this budget is an example of the last Congress's and the last president's priorities.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. We never really did talk much about the Democratic Unity Tour, which was in Kentucky. I'm wondering do you think that the Democrats are going to be able to capitalize on the resistance to move this forward?
Well, it's a good question. Think about how the last caller phrased it. People are demoralized, and Democrats are demoralized. This was not an election that was supposed to be a loss, and it's very hard to pick up the pieces for voters. And remember, it is the voters. I keep saying that win the elections. And if a voter is demoralized and sits out an election, that can have devastating consequences. So the Democrats have plenty of work to do, and that's the purpose behind Sanders and Perez's tour. Whether or not, though, that they can turn anti-Trump energy into pro-Democratic energy is the main question. And this is exactly what Republicans are suffering from right now. Yes, they technically have a majority, but they've spent the last 8 years demonizing President Obama. They didn't spend the last 8 years working on a unified message of ideological clarity. When you just want to win and win in any way possible, yes, you get power, but what is it that you're aiming to do with that power? And that's the kind of identity crisis that Democrats would not want to have. Democrats may seem to be more ideologically unified, but of course, Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders showed us they're not.
And we'll jump in because we are out of time for now. Thank you so much for being with us. Jasmine Ferrier is a professor of political science at the University of Louisville.